Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptor Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Placer, the owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
And our returning special guest from Arkane Games, lead designer and owner, Chris Park.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How's everything going with you?
Going good. We're working on some projects that we're excited about. We've had a little bit of a rough first quarter, but, we're bouncing back. So, all in all, good.
Yep, since we last spoke with you, you've released Shatterhaven, and you also announced two additional projects, which we'll be talking about later on in the cast. So, let's talk about Shatterhaven. Now, I think it was either the last time or the one before that, you were talking about how this was one of the longest-running development games from Arkane. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's been since 2008. I mean, it had not been continuous that whole time, mm-hmm. but it had been off and on.
Okay. Now, I guess the one thing that is different about Shatterhaven compared to Arkane's previous games is the fact that this is the first one that was completely linear, compared to your other games which have some element of procedurally generated or randomized design. How was it working with a linear design compared to your other types?
In terms of linear, I would like to clarify it's not completely linear because it does branch. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's some story branches and yada, yada, yada. But as to not being procedural at all, you're absolutely right. That's something that... Remember, this actually predates any of Arkane's other titles, so I had yet to even work with procedural generation by the time I had done, a large portion of the levels for this game. So, that's kind of my background, really, is, since I was like 9 years old, I had been doing levels for Demon Stalkers and Grawl and, just all these other games, and so... straight up just sitting down and designing levels or designing games is actually more my history, really. Mm-hmm. But then with AI War, that was when I first cut into the whole procedural thing, and it fascinates me, and it's something that we've become completely known for, but I'm not sure that I want to be known for just doing procedural games, but... I think probably procedural is more what I would do and mostly what I prefer, although I like the variety.
Yeah. We're definitely seeing, just like in general, with a lot of indie developers with that move to procedural or randomly generate design. I think it really does add a lot to the game. It really can give a game a lot more depth to it when it's handled right.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things is kind of marrying the two concepts together. And I think that's one thing that, Valley 2, for instance, did better than Valley 1 of our games, where Valley 1, like the level design was pretty completely procedural. And in the second one, it was cobbling together hand design building blocks. And I felt like that made for tighter level design and, it less varied level design in some ways, but at the same time, there was always that kind of human touch and not something that was just like, whoops, well, procedural generator farted there,
Yeah, when you have, like, complete procedural, you have those cases where, the game just gives you, like, a completely busted level, you have no way of getting out. I think I had that when I was playing this other indie game called Cargo Commander, that for some reason it just spawned me in, like, a room with no way out. I was like, oh, that's great.
That's a good challenge.
There's several passes generally that you have to make to a good procedural algorithm, and one is doing the procedural generation, and the second is analyzing what you have procedurally generated and looking for stuff like that and then correcting it. And that's not to say that the guys who made that game were slack at all, but what it does mean is that cleanup phase is what takes forever. With Valley 1, easily 90% of the procedural generation code was cleanup code. And I mean, it took me just months. And so there's, you'll always find little edge cases or whatever that slip through unless the game has just really been beaten on by a lot of players over a really long period of time. So, you know, that is one of the pitfalls of procedural generation. But with enough eyeballs on it, eventually that gets smoothed out.
So what exactly is your testing process to make sure that you're thorough enough?
Well, we have some automated unit testing that we do depending on the game. You know, it really varies depending on the type of procedural generation. By unit testing, I mean that it's, as part of the analysis process, it looks at the level and says, you know, can I pathfind through here to an exit? And, you know, is there, you know, can the character jump to everything that would let them get through here if it's a side scroll? Or any just general things like that. And if it's coming up with no as the answer, then it, you know, yells at us and says, hey, this didn't happen with this seed. And so we go in and look and see why and how we can correct that and so forth. And we typically have a little standalone tool that lets us just click next seed a whole bunch on a particular algorithm and then just spit, and it puts out a bunch of things until it throws up an error. And then we're like, what's going on with this one? That still doesn't catch everything because there's so many, you know, typically 2 billion seeds, you know. And so then it comes down to just having a big beta player base and what they find. So,
and how do you suggest other indies work for their first launch games? They don't have they don't have a big audience yet.
Well, you know, it's you know, you have to play your games, really. That's what it boils down to. And if there are some edge cases in a new indies title where something screws up, you know, in the procedural generation or whatever. If it's an edge case, it doesn't happen like all the time. Personally, I think that's excusable so long as it's corrected quickly and something that is, you know, either, you know, they don't have to go look for a new download. It's either through some sort of patching system built into the game or something through Steam or whatever. We do both. You know, so as long as the customer can get a fix really fast and it is legitimately an edge case, you know, this happens to 1 in 1,000 people or something, not like this is happening to everybody every day. You know, those sort of things, that's just inevitable part of being new and being small. If you do already have an audience, then, you know, there's a, you really ought to use it. And, you know, whatever unit testing you can do that's kind of automated, and then obviously testing within your own staff is also something you should do. And as a new indie developer, probably you have the advantage, depending, that you may already have a day job, so you're not under quite as much financial pressure, maybe, to get stuff out. There's obviously indie developer teams that are new that have quit the day job or that left AAA or whatever, and they're under probably the tightest financial pressure of anybody. But, you know, if you don't have that pressure, take the time, basically.
Yeah, I feel like, and this was a discussion we had before with some friends, I don't think it's possible to become successful. At least they argue that it's not possible for a studio to be successful if everyone's part-time. That if to make a truly successful game, everyone has to be full-time for the amount of hours you need.
It depends. I mean, look at Cave Story, you know? That was one guy part-time for 5 years. Obviously, it needed the same number of hours. It took him 5 years instead of part of a year. But, you know, and AI War was something that, you know, that I did as a part-time thing to start out with for AI War 1.0 and, you know, then went full-time after that. But, I mean, that one's grossed over $1 million. So, you know, I think it's unlikely. It makes it way harder if everybody's part-time. And as soon as everybody can go full-time, please do, you know. But in terms of dropping the day job prematurely because you think you can't succeed if you don't, I think that's probably a bad idea.
Well, I'm sure that's probably why they think that, you know, to begin with, that because of that rate of failure. But, you know,
yeah,
they make a pretty good point. But again, there's cases like you, obviously show that it's possible to have a successful game and do it part-time. And that could definitely lead someone down a interesting career path.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a matter of what your risk thresholds are, risk thresholds are and what your safety nets are. I mean, you know, if you don't have anything to fall back on financially and you quit your day job and you rush out a project, you know, one of the negative things about that is you can feel such pressure that quality suffers. And so I would make the counter argument that if you're feeling safe and secure and not rushed, that you're potentially liable to actually make a game that's better. It really all comes down to the individual specific circumstances, and that's something that's going to all. There's no one right answer. I mean, there's a million ways to skin a cat. You know, it's just
definitely. Yeah, I also say that going back with like the concept of working part time, if you are able to dedicate the time, I think that's perfectly viable. I've known people who will just like completely drop a project. And, you know, they'll focus on, you know, 5 or 10 other things. And then when I ask them, you know, what did you do? He's like, I did nothing. And then it's like, okay, so then how do we expect this programming to get done?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, I'm similar too, actually, and I'm trying to get better with my my attitude and trying to single out projects and finish them one by one instead of trying to do 10 at a time. Because when you do 10 at a time, you get nothing. You sputter your own wheels.
Right. The only reason I'm doing 2 at once at the moment is because we have the staff to do it. And so we're able to kind of share some staff across both the projects and then have different leads on each project. Mm-hmm. And that works out really well for us because you know, we're kind of focusing on somewhat smaller projects in terms of development time, but not in terms of, like, playtime scope. And that makes it so that, you know, we're just able to be focused, do 2 things at once. We kind of don't have all our eggs in one basket, which is nice. Yeah. And, you know, nobody's overworked or... And nobody in that kind... You know, one person, at least one person, has to hold the whole project in their head. You know, and that person can't be working on 2 projects primarily. That just can't happen. But people who are working on pieces of a project, sure, they can go back and forth. So if you have the staff for that, then you can maintain. You know, Nintendo can maintain as many projects as they want. They got plenty of heads there. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Going back to Shatterhaven, I do have a few questions I wanted to ask you in terms of about the design of it.
Sure.
I guess the first thing is, I know with Shatterhaven, one of the elements I liked about was the handcrafted puzzles. And I was just wondering, what was like the thought process or like the development time that went into each one of your puzzles for the game?
It's hard to say. It really varies. And part of the reason that I'm a little uncertain about that is because these were developed over such a long period of time. The bulk of the level design that went in there was done in 2008 by my wife and I. Almost all the levels were done in 2008 by her and I. She did about 30, I did about 60. And, you know, that took us about 8 months to do all of them, plus me coding the game and so forth. And then fast forward a number of years, to 2012, and then we started doing a bunch of edits to them and updating them, making them better, making the perspective better, updating graphics, updating this and that and the other. And so then there was all this editing time that came more recently, and exactly how that all balances out, it's hard to say. But in a general sense, you know, I did a developer let's play of how to use the level editor and came up with a, you know, fairly straightforward boss battle in about 45 minutes. And, you know, it was a single screen level and, you know, not super complicated. And that was about a 45 minute thing. Probably most of the levels take, you know, a couple of hours, some of them more than that, depending on exactly how big they are.
Okay. Now, I guess another question. I know when we last spoke, we talked about how you were designing the difficulty levels for it. Has anyone actually managed to beat the game at possibly impossible yet?
Not to my knowledge. I don't even try playing it on that. I like putting crazy options in there, and it possibly is impossible. there are levels that are possible to beat in that, and I've done it. There are some levels that may just literally be impossible because your dude isn't fast enough compared to the zombies. They are going to get him, sort of thing. And if that's the case, then it may actually make the game unwinnable on that difficulty. And it states that up front. And that's kind of the disclaimer on that one. But obviously, that's kind of the, you know, not really part of the real range of difficulty levels. That one's in there kind of more for extreme hardcore people. And if they run into something where they're absolutely stuck on that, they can use the level editor to get past it and then keep playing at that difficulty. It's kind of cheesy, but, you know, it's kind of a quasi-supported sort of thing. That the main three difficulty levels are, you know, have a plenty difficult to easy range as it is.
Now, one thing that I guess is somewhat of a spoiler, but when I play the game, I'm not sure if I got bugged or not, but after I beat the game, the first time I went through the mines, and then the second time I went through the sewer, and I think I got the same ending. Was there, in fact, two different ending cutscenes for playing through the game?
What you got were two different partial... Well, it depends. The ending is kind of a compound thing. Mm-hmm. And so if you went through the mines, there was a possibility that Pierce was going to die. Did he die for you?
No, I think he survived both games.
Okay. It's not possible for him to die on the route to through the sewers, basically. But it is, depending on what you do, it is possible for him to die in the mines route. And if that happens, then you get a dramatically different ending. If that doesn't happen, then the endings between those two routes are a lot more subtly different. There's some different wordings and so forth, but not as much as it would be. There are some other endings that we had planned to do and that we have the voiceovers for and the art for and everything, but that we haven't implemented in yet, because we're going to do those as post-release content up with the Shenzhen Research Facility, if you found that. But, yeah. But... The sales of the game have been such that it was something where we couldn't afford to put in that post-release stuff, at least not yet. We're still hoping that it'll catch on with folks because I think it's a cool game.
Yeah.
And if it does, then that will add about kind of 4-ish endings. They're kind of permutations of one another, so two broadly new endings and kind of two permutations of those two broad ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the, I forget, the actual name, those pamphlets, or you find those different symbol papers?
The combination papers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were they, a factor of the endings as well? Because I know I think I missed a lot of them. I think I got maybe 4 or 5 of them while I was playing through.
The first time you play through, that's probably a pretty good number, actually, because, maybe on the mines route you can get maybe 3, something like that. On the other route you can get another few. That doesn't play into the ending at all, although you have to get the lightning one in order to get into the Shenzhen facility, which would have the other endings if we go and add those at some point in the future. So basically those other endings are gated until you've actually beaten the game at least once. But there's a whole... I don't know if you found that. On the sewers path, there is a whole new overworld section there called Ganon Fields. And there's some combination papers that let you get in there. And you also have to have beaten the game to get to that. So there's this whole other section with some other levels that you can get to if you find the combination papers. There's 7 levels in there, maybe 9. Okay. I don't remember exactly. But so there's some hidden content that it unlocks, which is basically what those are for in general. But
okay, yeah, I'm not sure exactly where I got to because I ran into a bug. I think I reported a few bugs in terms of levels that were open, but I wasn't supposed to get to. So I kind of did a whole tour. I went through the mines, and then because the winter path was open, I kind of went through the winter to the swamp. The
right.
Other one, so I kind of did the whole round the world thing on my first playthrough.
Right. I hadn't noticed that was you on the bug report, but I remember fixing those and those being reported. Yeah. Yeah, that was an unexpected thing because it just didn't. There's an interesting article by the guy from God of War who was one of the guys who was designing God of War, who's writing about how you have to design games for, like, you know, the first thing players do is they're looking at something awesome, and the first thing they do is turn around and go to, you know, something else, and, you know, and start to, like, you know, seeing if they can jump on the boxes or whatever, and, you know, and he's like, you know, and that's how you have to design the games, because they're going to do something completely else, and it hadn't occurred to me that somebody would go that route that you did, because, of course, that's going backwards, not forwards. Elden Ridge is right there, but, of course, as the player, how are you supposed to know that, and, hey, there's stuff over here, let's go, but it's just one of those, you know, mental blips where it's like, oops, I should have thought that somebody would do that, but didn't.
Yeah, from all the games I play, I'm hardwired to always go the wrong way, because I always know someone's going to leave something really cool off the beaten track or a hidden key or something like that.
Exactly. That's how I play, too. I mean, if I'm like, my wife and I are playing, we're like, all right, well, that looks like the way to go, so we're going to go this way, because that probably means there's treasure, and then we'll be back to here. And then if we keep going far enough, we're like, this seems like this is the way to go. Let's go back the other way. It's just like, yeah, so exactly. You know, game design encourages that heavily, I think.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on and talk about your new project, Skyward Collapse. And I remember when I first read your blog post announcing the game, describing the gameplay, I was like, I don't quite understand what this is, but I think I want to play it. So instead of me trying to butcher the game idea, could you explain a little bit about what Skyward Collapse is?
Sure. So basically, it's a turn-based god game more than anything else, and it's kind of a simulation game, which is pretty much, god games are kind of a subgenre of that anyway. And you've got these two warring factions on these tiles that you're placing, red versus blue, and you can do any permutations of Greeks versus Norse, or Norse versus North, or Greeks versus Greeks, or whatever. And you can't control any of your guys directly. They're not really your guys. They have their own free will. But you can put them down there, and you can give them resources, and you can kind of indirectly control what they do by, controlling. They can't build buildings themselves, for instance. Mm-hmm. They'll produce their own military units, and they'll get their own, food and such, but they won't. You have to actually, provide that a source of food for them to get, and other buildings for them in terms of how exactly their towns are going to grow. And then they are pretty warlike and tend to try to make war. Although you can also pursue some diplomacy between villages, but it's not going to be a global thing in any particular game. You can't have a diplomatic victory, probably. Somebody's probably going to prove me wrong at some point, but I really think that would be pretty difficult to do. And at any rate, so it's kind of this a little bit herding cats, although that sounds unfun. But the idea is that you're trying to get them to fight as much as possible. You're not that benevolent, but at the same time, no genocide. So neither side's allowed to fully win, but each side generates score as they fight and build stuff and trade and do diplomacy and deal with bandits and deal with crime and all this other sort of stuff. And your score is whichever side has the worst score. So you want them both to do well, but you don't want either to outright get killed. So you're trying to essentially balance an unbalanced situation that's constantly getting back out of balance. So with our unit design and so forth, we've made things that are intentionally unbalanced in fun ways, which is something normally you can't do in a strategy game, because then that makes the game really easy and there's a best path, has the opposite effect here, where it actually makes the game freaking harder because you're trying to balance these things that are out of balance. I mean, like, you know, the Norse have much better mythological units, for instance, but the Greeks in general, their kind of human military was known for being really good, and they're better at the Norse, and better at that than the Norse. And the god, you can play with these very, you know, you get to choose gods as well. You put in a lesser and a greater for each side. So you've got, like, you know, Zeus versus Odin or whatever. And there's 16 in all you can choose from. And they have these powers, some of which are just crazy. It, like, you know, I forget which one. I think it's Thor. No, it's Odin has this power that can just murder everybody on the entire other side. Everybody dies, except the people who are indoors. It's not quite genocide, because there's people inside are okay, but everybody else dies. And of course, this racks up a bunch of points on the one side, you know, his side, and it completely, you know, screws up the other side. And what exactly did you just accomplish? Was that good? Was that bad? Well, it really depends, you know, because awesome, great, you know, military victory, but you're trying to keep this balanced. You just made tons of points, and the game, like, encourages you to do things like that to kind of mess yourself up in some way, so it's kind of hanging these carrots out there for you. But then it's like, well, can I recover from what I just did to myself? And, there's also this sort of thing where, like, if the Greeks were really, you know, beating it up on the Norse, and maybe you wanted that to happen, you're like, okay, I've got Odin, got this power, I'm ready to go when the Greeks have had their say. And so you're like, Greeks, beat the pulp out of these guys. And so the Greeks are just smashing the Norse, and then Odin's like, that's enough, you all die now. And so, you know, there's this whole back and forth, and it's a really unusual balancing process because, you know, we try, you know, our goal is to make it fun and unbalanced in fun ways so that you've constantly got this back and forth and the challengingness of it versus us trying to make a razor-thin balance that you can't exploit to win. It's totally backwards from a normal strategy game, and that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, are you controlling both sides of the field during, like, one single play?
In as much as you're controlling them at all, yes. So, assuming that you're playing solo, you basically take a certain number of actions per turn for each side. So you can put down some buildings or some land tiles or put down some, like, guys directly. You know, if there's a problem spot and you're like, oh, man, the Norse are kicking my Greek guy's butts over here. It's like, plop, Minotaur, you know. So there's things like that that you do each turn for each side. But then between what you're doing, this is where kind of the god game, sim game kind of parts come in. The guys do what they're going to do. You know, you've set up the scenario, basically, or altered the scenario between, you know, during your turn, and then they do stuff. And it may not always be the stuff you want to do, because they have some sense of self-preservation, and it's like, hey, you know, don't you want to kill that Minotaur guy? And he's like, no, that's a freaking Minotaur. I'm going over here, you know? And so you've got to come up with these kind of ways to encourage your fellas to do what you want. And so you are playing both sides in that sense, and so trying to create balance, but also carnage. You also have these secondary goals called edicts, which if you don't meet those, then you lose, which are things like, and you always have two, so there's kind of like, you've got to, you know, kill two gods during this game, and you've got to make sure that you have five towns, or something like that, on the Greeks, you know, on both sides. And so you're trying to do those things while also rack up a big score, while also not you know, letting genocide happen. And that's where it's kind of a you know, bring me the whip and switch boy sort of situation where you do it to yourself a little bit. And the better of a score that you're going for, the harder it becomes because of what you're doing. But if you want to play it at kind of a low level, it's kind of like chess or something where if you're playing it at a low level, the basic rules are pretty straightforward and you can play around with it and, you know, win against somebody else who's low level and it's, you know, it is what it is, but then it gets way deeper the more you tug at it. And, we are having co-op modes as well where you can play together, and we may do a PvP mode. That's something we're exploring, but it's a little tricky with neither side controlling a faction. There have to be kind of meta goals that you'd be going for, and we have a number of ideas on that. We've been talking with players about it, and it's kind of like, well, there's not one thing yet that I'm just like, yes, this is the way we can do PvP, and it'll be brilliant, but it's something we're looking at.
Okay. Now, with the goals you were just talking about, are they, like, chosen by the player at the start, or are they, like, randomized on game creation?
Either. So there's right now we've got, I think, 41 edicts to choose from, and you get to choose two of them. And they're grouped into three general categories, easier, medium, and hard. And by default, it puts you under a random easier, and so, you know, you'll get something that's random but not too taxing. It's still difficult to win, but not ridiculous. And if you prefer to pick something, you know, special to your liking, go right ahead. And, you know, if, as you get better, go up to random moderate or random harder, or, you know, pick ridiculous combinations that are incredibly difficult if you like.
Now, one thing I was reading about on the blog post was about how there were, like, goals you could accomplish during the game that, in the process, would unlock, like, new buildings and stuff.
Right. So there are, we're calling them challenges, where there's 100 of those, and there are things that, you know, like, kill 1,000 dudes in one game, you know, have 1,000 guys die in a game, or, you know, have a certain number of military units built across games, or, you know, just kind of meta goals like that. Some of them are harder than others. And for every 10 that you complete, they're ordered in general range of difficulty. For every 10 that you complete, then you unlock a new building, and these unlockable buildings do, for one thing, they have a bunch of points they give you when you place them. For another thing, they also have various other secondary effects. So, like, the Colosseum decreases crime, I think it is, plus also increases the military strength a little bit of guys coming out of the town that it's in. And, you know, you've got, like, the brewery, which lets you build some... has the ale resource comes out of that, so you're able to build some new military units that you couldn't before, but, you know, come on, ale, it also increases crime some. So you get a variety of these different things that, that unlock both some new units and new kind of ways to min-max. And you're given 5 of these challenges at a time, and as you complete them, then the one that you completed just slides out and another one pops in off the list, and so you can be working towards any or all of those 5 as you go.
Okay. Now, are these unlocked, like, just for that game, or are they unlocked for, you know, subsequent games?
So what you have is you can set up profiles on there, so you've got, you know, your named profile, which if it's just you playing, then you just have one. And on that profile, you would have a level as well as a bunch of stats and so forth. And so as you play games, you choose which profile you're playing as. And so then that's where the challenges are, is they're located on your profile. And as you complete them, then that unlocks stuff. Period from there. You're, okay. You can do a number of missions in one game, but it'll take a while to get to the very last of the missions. Basically, I mean, it would take dozens of hours to see everything in this game. So,
uh-huh. Now, as you were talking about, this is going to be turn based, and there's going to be different rounds that determine you choose a minor god and you choose a major god.
Mm-hmm.
How long are you playing like a single play to last?
That's something that the player can customize. So you can choose how many turns you want there to be in each round. Exactly how many we're going to make the default is something that we're still figuring out. And once we get to alpha testing, we'll nail that down a little bit more. Right now, what we've been playing with is 40 turns per round. So that makes 125 turns total, which, because there's a 5-turn phase zero where you get to place anything for free, which gives you off to kind of a quick start.
Okay.
And then after that, stuff starts actually moving and costing you resources. That's what we've been playing so far, but what we've always found is that the rate at which we play and the rate at which players play isn't necessarily always the same sort of thing. And so we need to get, you know, more player testing feedback before we really nail down, you know, what is the optimal baseline experience, and then players will be able to customize it, you know, up and down from there. I'm hoping that individual games will probably have, you know, at most like 45-minute rounds, but it really kind of depends, and that would again be the baseline. You know, if people want to play a 200 turns per round sort of game, they're going to be at it for a while.
Now, with the buildings, are the resources, like, are they, like, dependent on each side, or do you have, like, your own pool of resources that you draw on?
So each side has its own resources, and there are really two kinds of resources. There's, I forget exactly how many, it's like 11 base resources, where it's like, you know, rice, logs, pigs, stuff like that. And these things are produced outside of your towns. And those things, you have these little worker guys called chapmen that go out and collect them and bring them back to your town center, and then global for that faction after that point. So, you know, the number of pigs that you have on the blue faction side, that's just global for the blue faction.
Okay.
But then you've got what we call finished goods, which are produced on demand. And there's, I don't know, somewhere in 12 to 15 range of those as well. And those are things like swords, bacon, mutton, etc. And so lumber. And so in order for a specific town to be able to produce, let's say, bacon, which, you know, all foot soldiers need bacon. Come on. in order for a specific town to be able to have bacon, you need to have a butcher in that town. So you have to have globally some pigs, and then locally you need to have a butcher. This is actually a great example of one of the ways that you can indirectly influence what your guys are doing, because if you don't have a butcher, there is no bacon to go around in that particular village, despite the fact that globally you have pigs. So any units that require bacon to be produced, they're not going to be produced. And that's what gives you the control indirectly. You're like, oh, you think you're going to be making some pikemen? Well, let's see you do that without pikes, buddy, you know. So so instead they're going to build swordsmen, and you're like, all right, that's more like it. You know, it's, you know, go get those guys, the archers on the other side. You know, they don't have any horsemen. What do you need pikes for? You know, so that's kind of how, that's a great example of how you can indirectly control the economy. Well, not just the economy, but also the military. And that's another great example of, for a new player who's not trying to get like the super greatest score ever and is just trying to kind of achieve the easy edicts and so on and unlock some basic missions, you don't really have to worry about that. It's like, all right, well, I'm going to, whatever, some pikemen or some swordsmen, great, they're coming out and they're fighting, I'm happy, you know. For a min-maxer who's really trying to actually make some serious goals happen, it's like, okay, I know exactly what resources are going in each town, and I'm going to specialize my towns, and, you know, I'm planning this town based on its proximity to that enemy town as well, and, you know, you can set up a whole lot of interesting things, and that's where kind of the depth comes in with the more you play versus it being surface complex. Like AI War, you open the lobby of that thing and you know, holy cow, this is complicated. I mean, there's like, you know, 80 options there. You know, it's just like, oh my God. You know, and obviously I don't have a problem with that. I love AI War. I made it. I love games of that sort. But, you know, I've had a hankering for something a little more streamlined, but that still has that depth. And that is basically this game.
Cool. So what is the time frame for going into alpha and actually releasing the game?
So we're hoping to do a private alpha with just kind of some select players that give us some internal feedback before we go public with it at all, starting probably on Monday. The beta for that will probably start round about May 6th, so another Monday after that. And then 1.0 will probably be in the ballpark of May 20th through 23rd, somewhere in there. So round about a month, basically, until this is fully out.
Cool. I guess one last question I have regarding the design. So the gods that you choose from, what exactly do they affect besides having their special powers?
So each god that you choose, the lesser and the greater, they have some sort of passive effect that just while they exist, they do something. So, for instance, maybe your military on that side has 40% more health, or, you know, maybe your traders do like 20% more points and income from their trade, you know, those sort of things is pretty familiar to a lot of 4X sort of games. But the thing is, you don't have to choose that in advance of the game. You kind of see how the game is going after round one, and you're like, all right, now I choose my lesser god, and that affects things going forward. So you don't have to blindly choose. You get to kind of choose in reaction to things that have already happened, and that affects the future. And then after you get to round three, it's like, all right, now more has happened. What am I going to choose now for my greater gods on both sides? And the other thing that the gods do, that, I mean, they have each god has three powers that you can put down the tokens. They cost, you know, resources as well. But you put down a token, and the god moves to that token and then does something terrible. Other than that, the gods don't move. They just stand where you place them or the last place that you put a token. And they hang around there, and any guys that come in their range from the opposing faction, they pretty well one-shot. So you can use them as kind of a mobile, you know, meat shredder if you feel like it, or, you know, some sort of wall between somewhere that normally enemy guys would be going, or you can use them as some way to break up a trade route that just every time a trader walks by, he just gets his head chopped off. You can do some interesting things with the placement of the gods. And if you want to kill a god, you know, you can put a god next to another god and they'll fight it out, and whichever one is stronger will win. Or if they're about equally strong, then they will wind up killing each other. Or you have this kind of broadsword ability, which is military commandments, which you can, normally you can't give direct orders to your guys at all on either side. But, if you want to give an order to everybody on one side, that's what I mean by broadsword. Mm-hmm. It's not a subtle thing. You say, everybody take this down, all my military, or everybody kill this god. And normally your guys know not to go up and attack Thor. I mean, he's going to kill them. When you issue basically, you know, this is the 11th commandment, guys, it's kill Thor. And so they're like, well, I guess we better do it. And so they all go running and dying, and eventually Thor probably dies too. And so you can do things like that. Both to achieve edicts, to achieve missions, to change the balance of power in general, all sorts of reasons.
Cool. Definitely sounds like an interesting game. I like the idea of like this ordered chaos that you're trying to strive for.
Thanks. And that's something that I'm hoping will prove to be something that is fun right from the start and not overwhelming. We're going to great pains to make sure that it's kind of like, you know, when you first start playing some games, it's just like, oh my god, there's too many options, it's just crazy. Versus here, we're trying to kind of make it so that it's like, it's okay, you know, you don't have to understand everything to, you know, start playing this. You just, you know, let's go, you know, let's play a little, and you know, when you know more, then you're gonna start kicking some better butt, and that's fine. You know, so we'll see if we pull that off. That's what we're aiming for.
All right, Ken, do you have any questions about Skyward?
No, I'm just interested to see how it's gonna turn out.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, so I guess our last topic then is we can talk a little bit about Exodus of the Machine. And from what I was looking at on the forums, this is sort of like, not like a direct sequel, almost like a spiritual continuation of the AI War story. Is that right?
I think Keith won't mind me saying this. It's actually kind of a prequel.
Okay.
But yeah, it reveals more of the AI War universe story and what's going on with that. Because, you know, when you first start up AI War, it tells you about, you know, well, there was this great war between humanity, all this civil war that kept on going on, and then they created these AIs to help them fight, and then something happened, it's not quite clear what, and suddenly humanity's, like, next to wiped out, and the machines are now trying to kill them. And there are actually some questions raised in the original AI War of, was this a benevolent thing on the parts of the AI of, like, stopping the civil war and keeping humanity from killing itself? Or was this something where, you know, they exterminated us to the point that we were just kind of cockroaches to them and they hardly notice? It's kind of left unclear. And there's kind of some hints to both sides. And so Exodus shows some of what happened before.
Okay. And reading on the forums, you were describing the gameplay sort of similar to the Oregon Trail. And I saw someone like post like this awesome tagline, "You have died from dysentery and robots."
Yeah, I know. We're so going to use that. That was the best thing ever. Yeah, it's got some influences based on the structure of Oregon Trail. I mean, you know, Oregon Trail, you start out, you have to choose kind of your equipment loadout, basically, and then you go on this journey, and you have what you took with you and what you can forage, and you live or die along the way. And there's a lot of cool things about Oregon Trail, and there's a lot of nostalgia for that, and there's a number of really uncool things about Oregon Trail from a modern perspective as well, like the hunting game or some of the other random stuff. Dysentery actually is kind of a good example of that, where it's just like, oh, you randomly lose, sorry. And this one is more of a strategy game, though, where you choose what your starting loadout is, and you start on this journey, and you're trying to stop some bad stuff from happening, but at the same time your ship is crash landed, so you're at a double disadvantage. And you've got like these awesome weapons. Like, nobody can stand up to your weapons. Combat is easy, but you have very, very limited ammo. So, you know, there's gonna be a fair bit of combat as you go, so do you just blow all your awesome weapons right at the start? Maybe not the best idea. And so do you supplement those with native weapons or what? And, you know, of course, in your starting loadout, it's like, there's some funny video about, you know, Oregon Trail where it's like, just give me the bullets, you know, don't give me any food or any of the supplies. Well, you don't want to do that here either. You know, you need med kits and you need food and you need other stuff. You can forage for food and so forth. But, you know, every health point that you lose, every, you know, bullet that you fire, every interaction that you have that affects your reputation of, did you help this person or hurt this person? Did you piss off this faction or that faction? So forth and so on as you go. All that stuff is cumulative and permanent throughout your specific journey. And you can play, like with Oregon Trail, you can play the journey again and again with get different stuff. That makes it so that, you know, in AI War, that's one of the coolest things about that game is how you've got this protracted campaign through multiple star systems, and every decision you make matters and matters for the rest of the game. It's not like you just, oh, I lost a life, now I restart and get you know, get to do things again from full health or something. Okay. You know, this is a little more, permanent. You know, you want to make your decisions carefully.
So is it like Orc and Trail, there is a set endpoint, or does the end differ based on your actions during the game?
There are a couple of different endings that you can get. There are some, basically, there's some little cutscene sequences that are fairly fixed, although it branches, that happen as you go. And you'll, you know, always run into some of those, depending on what choices you make. Between those is where you go what we call the travel segments, which are more randomized, where you get, you know, those are always different, where you run into different, you know, natives that want or need different things from you, or hostile or not, or helpful or whatever, and you run into various monsters that you, or other enemies that you have to combat, and, you know, things of that nature. So those parts are always different. And so then you arrive at one of the various endings, depending on, you know, the culmination of all of that. So this is a great example of what we were talking about earlier, of kind of marrying the procedural and the non-procedural, because it's basically, you know, procedural stuff from point A to point B, but then point A and point B are kind of fixed, but then branching to C and D, and then there's procedural stuff between B and C and B and D. So, if that makes sense.
Let's see. So, you said that this was going to be a strategy game. Does that mean will there be, like, any, like, mini-games, like you talk about, like, the hunting game in Oregon Trail? Is it just going to be, like, one main system, or will there be, like, certain, like, things you can change or interact with during the play?
Well, there's not mini-games in the sense that you mean it. We weren't a fan of the hunting mini game. As you're playing, you have to make a variety of choices in general, and the overall interface fairly much remains the same. But you have, you know, you have four characters and possibly others that are following each of the individual characters. So you have four basically party leads, and then they might have kind of foot soldiers following them, and with them, they each have their own inventory and stuff like that, and you have to decide when and what they're going to do. You know, if it's night, who's going to stay up and, you know, keep guard, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So you make these decisions, and they have ramifications. Then there's also kind of the encounters would probably be the closest thing to kind of a mini game, where you get somewhere and you're like, all right, this guy wants some food. We have only so much food. Do we give it to him or do we not? You know, do we do what he wants? If you do, then, you know, certain parts of your reputation go up. If you don't, then you're considered a little bit more of a jerk by other people, and maybe stuff later on goes, you know, maybe some other people a little bit later on are less nice to you, but you have more food at least. You know, so there's these kind of pros and cons of the things that you might choose to do. And then with the combat's probably the closest thing to a mini game. It's a little more kind of Dragon Warrior might be kind of the closest analogy, I guess, to kind of how the combat is. It's, you know, menu-based combat with, you know, you see the monster and so forth. Although there's a cool thing with range to the monster, and the monster's closing range as the battle goes on, and so that's pretty different. But so there's a variety of things going on, but it's, you know, the kind of the baseline number of choices that you get to make are a lot more interesting than, say, Oregon Trail. So the need for separate mini games where it's like, okay, that was boring, now here's something else, is not quite there. You know.
So with Skyward, you're talking about the time frame of having it sort of finished by the end of May. Well, how does Exodus look like? What are you playing for in terms of alpha, beta release for that?
We're hoping to be to beta in May, and hoping to have a 1.0 in June. We have been having some pipeline problems. I'll leave it at that. With getting some things ready for it. It's coming along well, but there's been some issues that have prevented us from getting to beta. So, but anyway, we're hopeful that we'll be able to get that out on the time frame that we're looking at.
All right. Ken, do you have any other questions for Exus?
No, I'm definitely going to check out the trailers, though, for his other games. Because I just saw the post on Reddit now.
Sweet.
Yeah, definitely sounds great. So I think we're going to wrap it up. I won't keep you two away because you got some busy stuff to do.
Yeah, it's a little bit busy these days.
All right, so I would like to once again thank Ken and Chris for being on the podcast this week.
Absolutely, thank you.
You got it.
And you're always welcome back.
I appreciate it.
All right, so we're going to end things here. And for those of you listening, we are always looking for future podcast guests or writers. And if you are interested, please click on the Submissions Wanted link on our front page. And that will do it for us here at the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you next time. Take care, everybody.